or Commander Kontos called the other engines back into the CIC. Frost, Ghost, and Jackson had joined them at the comm station, having just replayed the message.
Why are we listening to Cross?
What?
That's not possible.
Okami growled. The wolfdog's hair stood straight along his spine. Akira looked to the wolfdog.
He senses something.
A beeping echoed through the room, drawing attention to the sonar station. Captain Thomas hurried over to examine it.
Contact. 75 clicks out, headed our way fast.
He turned to War Commander Kontos.
This must be related.
Akira stared back at the bank of radio equipment, a chill hitting the back of his brain. Memories of the moments leading up to E-Day rushed through his mind. The events on the Titan space elevator that led to the death of Perez. The escape of Dr. Cross. Somehow the wicked scientist had survived and was back on Earth.
How is he still alive?
Unidentified, closing in fast. This thing is big, Captain, twice the size of the Pelican.
Thomas turned with a look of shock and fear.
Battle stations.
All hands, battle stations. Repeat, all hands, battle stations.
Akira looked at Thomas, who nodded to a weapon station to the right of the helm, then directed Frost to a weapon station to the left. The Ghost and Jackson ran off the bridge down a passage to turrets on the starboard and port sides. Akira activated the weapons system while he put on a headset.
War Commander.
Copy. Stand by for orders.
Akira tapped the data pad in front of his seat, pulling up the passive sonar. Only 50 miles to the west, the same blob of green he had seen not an hour earlier was moving again, solidified now.
What is it?
Good question.
Whatever it is, it's moving fast.
Too fast. Too fast to be a whale or a giant squid. Has to be another sub, the machines.
Akira watched the data as the submarine dove deeper, hitting 15,000 feet.
We're moving at full speed, and the thing is still gaining on us, Captain.
Priming plasma cannons, 1 and 2.
As the sub dove deeper into the inky black, Akira saw that they were heading right for a ravine that would provide cover. The contact was only 30 clicks away.
Shit, this thing is really moving.
While Akira started the sonar, he thought of Dr. Otto Cross and whether the transmission and this thing chasing them were connected. But he shook the thought away as the submarine descended into the crushing depths.
Captain, entering trench.
Understood. Full right rudder and kill all non-critical systems.
Aye, Captain. Full right rudder and cut all non-critical systems.
The submarine deftly turned, and the 50,000-ton vessel slotted into the crevice, lowering into the black, all non-critical systems shutting off. Silence gripped the vessel. The cameras captured a translucent squid gliding overhead. The body glowed a faint blue, lighting up the jagged sides of the trench. The captain tucked the submarine under a shelf of rock, and Akira lost sight of the creature on screen. He looked back to the passive sonar and the enormous contact inching closer. It knew they were here. The contact blinked closer on the screen. And then, just like that, it began to dissipate again, spreading outward like ash from a burning leaf on the screen. Akira squinted at the motion on the video feed. About 500 feet above them, right above the ledge, he spotted a blue flash of metal or scales.
Fish. A school of fish. But how could a school of fish track us and why?
A moment later, the elongated bodies of sea creatures darted downward. All at once, they glowed blue, illuminating a school of not fish, but translucent squid with metal tentacles. Hybrid squids. There had to be 100, maybe even thousands of the creatures. Just like the ones he'd seen minutes ago. Creatures that only Apeiron could have created.
Apeiron?
You gotta be kidding.
Fire at all targets!
Frost unleashed hundreds of bolts that sizzled through the water. The cybernetic creatures suddenly went dark, their blue bag-like bodies winking off like lights on the video feed.
I can't see them. I can't see anything.
Several of the contacts blinked off the sonar.
Keep firing! You're hitting some of them!
The first of the squids slammed into the outer hull of the sub. An impact echoed throughout the vessel. Akira flinched as he could see them up close on the monitor. Their tentacled arms wrapped around the plasma gun turret and began to radiate blue as they wiggled about over the metal. Frost moved the barrels back and forth, trying to free the turret. In the video feed, Akira noticed inky blood spread out in the water. These things were still part animal. He knew Apeiron had been searching the globe to study apex predators, and now wondered if this was some sort of secret project Apeiron had been conducting before E-Day, and if the message from Dr. Cross was one of Apeiron's tricks. Static hissed from the comms, followed by a violent rumble that shook the vessel.
The turret is broken!
Alarms blared through the vessel. More impacts shook the Pelican. Akira braced himself against a bulkhead.
Cross! You okay?
Fine.
Get back to CIC.
By the time she got to the CIC, the entire room was a scene of chaos. Officers shouted over the noise, and red warning lights blazed as more impacts to the hull shook the submarine.
Full engines! Left rudder!
Full engines! Left rudder!
Rise! Make your depth 3,000 meters!
Rising to 3,000 meters!
The submarine motored out of the ravine to escape. Akira noticed the contacts on the sonar were suddenly starting to move away from the Pelican. Only they weren't fleeing, they were regrouping. The beast formed a single colossal squid that whipped its tentacles around the sub.
Fire the torpedoes!
Load and fire torpedoes at will!
Sir, torpedo tubes 9 and 10 are still offline.
Tubes 1, 2, 3, and 4 aren't responding either.
What about our sea-to-surface missiles?
We're too close. If we fire one, we're dead. It would be a risk to fire a torpedo, let alone one of the sea-to-surface missiles due to pressure and proximity.
The hull groaned. On the screen, the hybrid squid squeezed at the sub. It crunched through the plasma turrets, leaving them defenseless. Akira's mind raced about how these creatures had tracked them here. They had raced away after his transmission. Unless the beasts had been following them before the transmission. The mammoth animal finally loosened its grip and swam around them, circling like a vulture over dying prey. Captain Thomas stood in front of the monitors, eyes flitting back and forth.
Captain, what are your orders?
I don't know. Due to the depth, we shouldn't risk firing any torpedoes, even if we can get them online.
Ghost exchanged a worried glance with Akira, and Okami whined alongside Frost. The squid continued to circle, racing around the damaged vessel.
Captain, we're getting a new message. This time, it's just text.
Thomas looked over at a holoscreen, displaying an incoming text. Surrender. Rise to the surface. We have been tracking you since Japan. You cannot escape. Akira had been right about the squid following them since before his transmission to the surface. This wasn't on him. But whoever was behind these squids wanted the submarine to lead them to more survivors. And was the transmission from Otto too much to be a coincidence? Akira stared in horror at a realization that maybe Apeiron wasn't their only enemy. Maybe Dr. Otto Cross was out there somehow. Maybe Shadow Squad now had two enemies.
Torpedo Tube 8 is back online. Permission to fire.
Captain Thomas stiffened and looked to War Commander Kontos.
It might be our only chance.
Captain Thomas nodded.
Fire torpedoes. Hit that fucker right in the guts.
Ronan and his mother and brother had joined thousands of colonists to watch the execution of disgraced Dr. Jason Crichton on a holoscreen in the town center of the Halo subcolony in Mesopotamia under the Shackleton crater of the moon. The mood soured when, on a perimeter feed, he had been hauled off in a tactical rover. Ronan was more interested in the person that had pulled the doctor into the rover. It had looked like Lieutenant Tige Walsh.
Execution 2 will broadcast in T-minus 10 minutes. Stand by for an update from War Commander Thacker.
Like many of the thousands of people around Ronan, he hated the man who had created the machines that killed his father and brother. Almost 2 hours after the canceled execution, the colonists were getting more agitated as they waited. The recent announcement threatened to set off a small riot. LDC troopers patrolled around the chamber, watching the crowd carefully. Ronan's mother had been reluctant to come to the execution for this very reason, especially after what happened during the last time they had come for rations. But it was their growling, empty stomachs that had brought them back here for the possibility of getting fed. They had succeeded, and now the rations were tucked inside the backpack Ronan wore over his chest to further protect against opportunistic thieves, especially in crowds like this. He even kept a hand over the pack, making sure the precious contents were safe at all times. The wait finally ended, and the holoscreen in the center of town flickered to life with the hardened face of War Commander Thacker. The colonists fell into silence.
Citizens of Mesopotamia, as you know, I've been tasked with the honor of keeping you all safe. To that end, we have delayed the execution of Jason Crichton tonight because he is still valuable to us. But we have another scheduled execution for you for a man that possesses an immediate threat to the colony.
A secondary holoscreen emerged with the face of a prisoner that Ronan instantly recognized. It was the Coalition man who had killed the LDC trooper during rations the other day. Dark, soulless eyes stared at the camera as he was prepared for execution. Ronan had seen several executions since E-Day. Criminals, former Coalition, and even supporters and staff of Crichton's had been sent out onto the moon to die. At first, it seemed extreme to Ronan, but Thacker always reminded the refugees that these people were responsible for why they were on the moon. He wouldn't care if they all burned. The view zoomed out, showing the shackled prisoner wearing nothing but white pants in a small chamber with metal walls. His muscular body told a story of war like the Warrior Codex. Scars cut across his flesh, and tattoos branded his body. The man kept his gaze on the camera.
Life at Mesopotamia and the five sub-colonies is fragile. We must be honest about it, and that is why anyone who threatens our ecosystem will meet this same fate. We won't even waste a suit on this terrorist or anyone like him. All enemies of the LDC will be hunted down and eliminated.
On the holoscreen, flames vented out of the floor, clawing up the prisoner's legs. His face twisted in agony, but he kept his eyes on the camera. Lise turned to Ilan and Ronan, but she didn't shield them from this macabre punishment. This was nothing compared to what they'd seen on E-Day. The prisoner kept staring until he was completely devoured by the fire. When it was over, not a single person in Halo Colony said a word. War Commander Thacker continued speaking like nothing had happened, clearly unfazed by the man they had burned alive.
The machines are not the only threat to our survival, and I have made no secret of the fact we are facing multiple struggles, including limited resources. But my promise to all loyal colonists will never change. I will do everything to protect you against internal and external threats, from Coalition terrorists to a Piran.
After a stern nod at the camera, the holoscreen vanished. The colonists began to disperse in no apparent disagreement with the war commander. But Ronan didn't trust the man. He had fled Gold Base instead of staying behind to fight. How could someone like that protect the colonies? But maybe that's exactly what was needed. Someone who knew when a fight was lost and to guard the colonies. He shook away the thought, recalling an ancient saying from the Warrior Codex. The best defense is a strong offense. They should have been doing something for Earth, anything to help. Living down here wasn't surviving. It was just waiting to die. And as Ronan left the chamber, his mind seemed to focus on one thing, fighting back. Lise turned before entering the wide passage leading back to their home.
Keep the pack secure.
Ronan patted it in response. They set off down a connecting tunnel, taking a different way to the communal living chamber. Retrofitted mining offices framed the walls inside the tunnel. The spaces transformed into small shops and official LDC offices. Standing in front of one of them were two more troopers in their gray and white armor, watching the crowd filter by. Their hands never seemed to stray from the hilts of their energy blades. They guarded the recruiting station, where everyone between the age of 18 and 35 were required to check in for conscription. Ronan and Ilan were 6 months away from their 18th birthday. While Ilan would likely be turned down for service, Ronan would surely be accepted. He was excited about the prospect of training to be a trooper when the time came. His mother took him and his brother down a ramp into a wide tunnel with hundreds of other people. Stands along the walls served as small storefronts where people bartered for goods.
Do you know who I am?
Most people kept going, but several, like Ronan, sidestepped and stopped to watch a bald man wearing a black sport coat with gold cuffs. He was standing up to a taller man, this one wearing gray pants and a sweatshirt fitting snugly over his wide shoulders and whose face soured.
I don't give a shit who you were. Give me those damn cuffs.
The wealthy-looking man glanced down. He seemed to consider taking them off and handing them over for a moment, but then shook his head.
I will not be intimidated by your...
Before he could finish his sentence, the would-be thief headbutted him in the nose. The crack echoed in the enclosed tunnel as the man slumped to his knees, hands holding back the flow of blood. Ronan moved out of habit, wanting to help, to stop this injustice. It's what his father Kai and Uncle Akira would have done. His mother snagged his arm.
Don't.
Mom, we can't just let these people...
I lost one son. I won't lose another.
Three more thieves descended upon the falling man, pulling off his coat, boots, and stripping him of everything valuable. By the time an LDC soldier arrived, the men had fled. Everyone walked by like nothing had happened. Sights like these were becoming more and more normal. Ronan would do anything to go back to the normal days of living in the slums of Mega City Phoenix, in the small apartment with his brothers and parents. But those days were gone. They took a left into a smaller connecting passage that led to the communal space. Hundreds of people were lounging about their bunks. Ronan was relieved to be heading back to bed, exhausted from the dread of their current situation. He didn't want to admit it might be depression. His mother was dealing with it too. Same with Elon, although he was trying to hide it. People lingered in the dim lighting of the large chamber. Some of them were talking. Others were sharing meals of rations and water. The harmonious notes of a guitar rose over the coughs and conversations. Ronan's mother seemed to freeze as if she recognized the song as a wet sheen formed over her eyes. When the song ended, a new one began, and Ronan sat on his bed to pull out the rations. Tonight, the music helped calm the chamber. He didn't hear any fighting or shouting, just the guitar. Picking up a handmade broom, Lee started cleaning their space, sweeping out the dust that had already collected. It helped her feel normal, this one thing she could control, keeping their small shelter clean. Across from them, Todd and Mickey were sitting and eating their rations. Lee finished cleaning, then spoke and signed to Ronan and Elon.
Do you care if I ask them to eat with us?
Elon signed back no, as Ronan shook his head.
Wanna join us for dinner?
Todd looked up to see Lee's, then down to Mickey. The young man shook his head.
Come on, it'll be a nice change of pace.
After a few moments, they walked across the aisle with stools, entered Ronan's family area, and took seats. It was awkward at first, but Ronan broke the ice.
I heard the Lunar Council is talking about sending kids to school. What grade are you, Mickey?
Mickey took a bite of his yellow energy bar.
Senior? You guys?
Same.
Chewing, Mickey looked to his dad, who had turned to Lee's.
I made an application, and I'm being considered for a job as a trooper, despite a bad leg.
Did you play any sports, Mickey?
Baseball, but I didn't really like it.
How about droid raiding?
Mickey scowled.
Nope. Never cared to watch people beat up on machines. Maybe that's why Apeiron turned on us. Or maybe she just realized humanity wasn't worth saving. Either way, doesn't matter now, does it?
It matters.
Why?
Because the war isn't over. I still think my Uncle Akira is fighting on Earth. Sergeant Walsh told me that you can never count an engine out of a fight.
Your uncle's an engine?
Lee's looked at Ronan, but said nothing.
No offense, but engines are obsolete.
Todd gave him a stern look.
You don't know my uncle.
Nope, but I know what I saw on E-Day.
Mickey got up and left, walking back across to his living area. Ronan stood, anger in his eyes. But he then recalled thinking the same thing on E-Day when the engines had lost the fight in Mega City Tokyo. Todd looked back across to Mickey, then to the remnants of the Hayashi family.
Sorry, he's been through a lot. I mean, we all have. I know you guys have too.
It's okay. We're all just trying to survive, emotionally and physically.
Ronan, still angry, sat back down. A kid, maybe 17 or so, suddenly ran past the open drape, darting down the aisle between the two abodes.
Oi, you! Come here!
Ronan got up and went to the opening as two troopers bolted by. He stared as the guards tackled the boy near the exit of the chamber. A woman rushed over.
Please! He's all I have left!
The soldiers hoisted the kid to his feet. Ronan saw he wasn't much older than himself and Elan.
No! Please!
The soldiers took him away while another trooper restrained the woman.
He's 18. Your son will serve, just like the rest of us.
Lee stepped up next to Ronan and placed a hand on his shoulder. It was clear soon Ronan and Elan would be conscripted.
Ronan, stay with your brother.
Where are you going?
I'm going to look for work in Mesopotamia. I can't survive like this. There has to be something I can do to help us.
Back aboard the NAA Pelican in the depths of the Philippine Sea, Akira and Ghost worked their way through a dark passage. Both wore their engine armor, repaired from E-Day, but still not fully functional. The submarine continued to putter through the water on borrowed time. They had killed the hybrid monster with their torpedo, but it came at a cost in the form of internal damage to the Pelican. Fortunately, the integrity of the outer hull remained strong, doing exactly what it was built to do, survive the deepest parts of the ocean. That didn't mean it would hold forever. They had lost power to a frontal bow compartment and were now set to fix the issue manually. The vessel shook violently. Akira grabbed a pipe, held on, and waited for the quaking to pass. When it did, he and Ghost continued until they reached their destination, a hatch that sealed off compartment 4. A devastating fire was blazing on the other side. 4 inches of steel separated Akira and Ghost from the compromised compartment. As soon as he entered, he would be swallowed by an inferno. Ghost activated a holoscreen with the blueprint of the vessel and pointed to a pipe that snaked through the next passage.
We need to shut off this valve. That'll turn off the gas feeding this fire.
We get in and out. Our armor can only take about a minute before the heat shields fail, and we cook inside our suits.
The two then closed and sealed with their helmets, and Akira grabbed the wheel handle. It was hot to the touch, even through his thick armored gloves.
On three!
Ghost held up the fire extinguisher. It wouldn't kill the fire, but it would buy them some time.
One, two, three!
He twisted the wheel, unlocking the hatch. The door swung open, venting flames. Ghost hopped into the blast, firing the extinguisher as Akira stepped in and pulled the hatch shut behind them. Flames danced all around as Akira followed Ghost into the blaze. Waves of chemical spray chased the flames away, opening a fragile path. It took them 10 brutal seconds to locate the valve on the other end of the passage. They pushed through the hellish compartment toward it. Jagged, bent metal reached out at them. Akira had to stop Ghost in front of a ravine through the deck. Flames licked upward, retreating when Ghost directed his spray.
Go, go!
Running ahead, Akira leapt over the opening and grabbed the valve. He tried to turn it, but the superheated metal burned his gloves. His suit warned him the insulation was compromised when the idea came.
Blast it!
Ghost aimed the spray at the handle and fired. A sudden tower of fire enveloped him and Akira. He turned away as Ghost turned the spray at the flames. Akira turned back to the valve, grabbed it, and put all of his muscle into it. The handle, still scorching to the touch, burned through his gloves and into his flesh. The valve finally clicked, moving slightly as the metal burned deeper into his right hand. Akira closed his eyes, trying to ignore the agonizing pain. He summoned the anger that had fueled his thoughts and nightmares. Using that pent-up rage, he turned the valve until it clicked again. The flames retreated around him, and he fell to his knees, staring down at his smoldering gloves. Ghost leaned down to help him up.
You still got it, Cap. Well done, brother.
Akira winced as Ghost helped him to his feet, and they made their way back up through the dark vessel. Frost and Jackson were working with the crew to put out a fire in another compartment of the submarine as Akira and Ghost walked up. Corporal Bella Oliver walked over with a medical pack.
Captain, better let me take a look at you.
I'm fine. Just my hand.
Akira took off his gloves, exposing blistered flesh on his remaining right hand.
That isn't fine. We need to get you to the infirmary.
Please, just wrap it for now.
Okay, but this doesn't mean you get to skip infirm.
Bella bent down and opened the pack. Frost and Jackson walked over, their armor smoldering.
Pelican's in bad shape. A torpedo about turned us into squid ink.
If we're being tracked by Cross or Pyrrhon, or whoever is out there, we should expect more of those things to hunt us.
Bella finished the quick field dressing of Akira's hand.
All done.
Thank you.
Akira made his way to the CIC with the other engines. Captain Thomas was talking with his officers while War Commander Kontos stood back and watched with his arms folded across his chest.
Where are we?
About 80 miles from the site of the attack. Critical systems are online, but we're still struggling. I'm not sure yet if we will make the dive to Neptune Station.
Perhaps this is destiny, and a sign we should surface to look for survivors and kill some machines. Beats diving and popping like pimples from the pressure.
We dive to Neptune Station, and we could die. But if we surface now, we definitely die. And while I'm all for fighting when the time is right, that time isn't now. Especially after what just happened. We don't even know who sent those squids after us.
Frost and Ghost both nodded. Jackson snorted and shrugged a shoulder.
Just keep trying it.
Thomas crossed the CIC, sweat dripping down his wrinkled brow.
Captain, are we sure we're not being followed again?
Thomas ran a hand over his short hair.
We aren't picking up anything on passive sonar, so unless Pyrrhon has found a way to make her new monsters invisible, we're safe for now.
Do we know the full extent of the damage yet?
Yes, and we have stopped the bleeding, so to speak, but we can't make all the repairs here. Hopefully, what we have done is enough to improve our odds of survival if we do dive for Neptune Station.
What are our odds if we do?
Captain Thomas canted his head to the side in thought.
As you know, Neptune Research Station is deep at the bottom of the Mariana Trench. This is one of the most advanced submarines ever built, designed to reach those depths. And I know her like the back of my hand, but even she has her limits, especially with the damage we sustained.
The captain looked the war commander in the eye.
I'd say our odds are better, thanks to Shadow Squad's efforts in putting out the fires. But there is still a monumental risk due to the pressure if we dive to Neptune.
Kanto seemed to think on it a moment, but then made the decision all commanders hated by giving an order that put all of their people in jeopardy.
Finish any last-minute repairs to increase our odds and hope that what we can't fix here doesn't kill us.
Thomas nodded and hurried back to his crew. The war commander turned to Akira.
I want Shadow Squad ready to secure the station when we dock.
Yes, sir.
The engines entered the troop hold. There, Kichiro was still standing offline in his cage. Okami trotted over, tail wagging. Akira bent down and reached out with his bandaged hand. Frost gave the injury a nod.
That looks terrible.
It looks worse than it is.
Ghost took a seat on a crate as Jackson paced.
We're going to be crushed like Tig used to crush Hummer droids.
Jackson kicked a stack of crates. He dented one, and the two on top tumbled off. Okami growled.
Will you shut that?
Akira stood.
I'm not a big fan of machines right now.
It wasn't an apology, but Akira did understand. Still, he feared the other engine was starting to lose it. He would not let the man take his anger out on Okami. Frost threw a look to Akira.
Let it go.
Akira glared at Jackson, who seemed to relax and back down. Jackson picked up the crates and stacked them back into a neat tower, relieving the tension.
I've been cooped up in this coffin for too long.
Frost raised a brow.
First time I've ever heard you apologize. That was an apology, right?
Jackson shrugged.
I admit when I'm wrong.
He held out a hand and Akira shook it, ignoring the pain of his burns for the sake of their reconciliation.
All your anger will not bring back the dead, Lieutenant. Don't forget why we fight. For the living. And the time will come to do that soon.
Okami growled, but this time not at Jackson, as a whining noise reverberated through the submarine.
Must be getting ready to dive. Ghost, you want to sing us something motivational?
Ghost looked away with a passing thought and gave a shake of his head as the engines all stepped over to the bulkhead mounted armory where they pulled out their RS-3 pulse rifles and energy swords, preparing for whatever waited at Neptune Station. Akira glanced at Ghost.
You okay, brother?
I'm starting to feel like Jackson.
Not sure this is the right move.
Before Akira could reply, Kontos entered the cargo hold, ducking below the overhead.
At ease. I'm here because I want to be with you all during the dive.
Metal groaned and creaked around them. Akira looked at Okami, who let out a low whine right before another vibration screeched through the hull.
I'll be honest with you all. I was always a believer in AI until E-Day, but I was also spiritual in the sense I believe in something greater, something non-AI that created us. I never admitted it before, but I pray to a supreme being from time to time, and this is one of those times. If there is something out there, please watch out for us now and give us a chance. A chance so we can rise up and fight again, like Akira promised.
The engines all nodded, and Ghost stepped in front of them.
I thought of something to sing. I'll keep it short.
He took in a deep breath, exhaled, and replaced the lyrics of the former Nova Alliance hymn about AI.
Engines are salvation.
Three LDC troopers, a woman and two men, stood in front of Tig inside the underground hangar at Kepler Station. A moth waited to take them to their first assignment. He still didn't know why the execution of Dr. Jason Crichton had been nixed, or why he'd been called to extract him from the surface. That was above his pay grade. But in a way, he was relieved that he would get the chance to see if maybe, just maybe, the disgraced doctor could help the LDC. For now, Tig had a mission to focus on. Work with this new team to protect the colonies from the machines. Shortly, they would travel to the Shackleton crater to help prepare Mesopotamia for what they suspected to be an imminent attack. Tig easily stood at least a foot taller than each of the new team members.
All right, shitheads. My name is Sergeant Tig Walsh. For the foreseeable future, you're under my direct command.
They just stared up at him, expressions dull and placid. He was used to joking with Shadow Squad. These three probably didn't know how to take his humor.
Okay. What do you all know about why you're here?
You're an engine.
Yeah.
You're from Shadow Squad.
The Shadow Squad.
So, everyone here has eyes. Great. Now give me a breakdown on your experience. I'd like to know who I'm fighting beside.
He centered his gaze on the young woman first. She looked maybe 21, with freckles and short hair that spiked over her brown eyes.
Lambo, you first.
Corporal Veronica Lambo, 23 years old and born in Mega City, Miami.
She hesitated, then gulped hard and raised her head with pride.
At 18, I graduated at the top of my class and entered the Mega City, Miami University of Computer Engineering. I graduated early, top of my class again 3 years later. I immediately entered the Nova Alliance Strike Force as a computer specialist with a concentration in cybersecurity.
Makes sense why you were assigned to this unit.
Tig moved on down the line and nodded to Joaquin Flores, a Latino man with a buzzed head, sharp nose, and brown eyes who flashed a cocky grin.
Corporal Joaquin Flores, 29, born in Mega City, Los Angeles. I'm a Devil Dog Sergeant, specialty in demolition.
Tig had a lot of respect for the Devil Dogs. Joaquin had been part of the elite branch of the military that had evolved from the Marine Corps branch over 50 years earlier. The Devil Dogs were a diverse group of pistons that were almost completely self-sufficient. They could do pretty much anything on and off the battlefield, surpassed only by the engines. Finally, Tig stopped in front of Ronald. The young man was tall, thin, and had a mop of orange hair. His brown eyes were focused on the hilt of Tig's sawtoothed energy sword, rising above his back.
Corporal Ronald Bryan, 29, born in the slums of Mega City, Baltimore.
Veronica and Joaquin both gave Ronald a side glance, as Mega City, Baltimore was known for their violence, drugs, and all-around miserable living conditions. There was usually two ways out, death or the Nova Alliance Strike Force. Despite his wiry appearance, Ronald had Tig's respect for that.
I received the Nova Alliance Rising Star Award for my droid designs and was accepted into a classified program my second year with the NASF. There, I worked with Achilles Android Systems before ending up here.
Surprised you're still alive. The LDC has been killing off most of the scientists that work with Dr. Crichton.
Because they deserve to die.
I guess I'm lucky.
No, you're valuable. Someone thinks all you are, which is why you're here. Our objective is to analyze the current defenses at Shackleton Crater and make recommendations to protect Mesopotamia from any potential Phase 2 attack. Let's rack it.
Dyke motioned for the team to load up into the Maw. The troopers followed him in their bulky white and gray armor, boots and helmets that reminded him of Pistons he had once teamed with on an Arctic mission. The only major difference were the black exoskeletons that they wore from their waist down to their boots. Those mechanisms helped them move more efficiently in the low gravity on the surface. Tig had a similar rig set up on his armor. His boots were also equipped with magnets to make EVA walks and low-grav environments easier to handle. The three soldiers strapped in across from Tig as the two pilots climbed into the cockpit. Tig checked the diagnostics on his suit by pulling up his HUD, while fighting every urge to steal this moth and fly it right to Mega City, Tokyo. It would be all too easy to kick the new squad out of a hatch, then yank the pilots out and take off. Clearing Kepler Station would be no problem, but getting past the cannons and King Cobra spaceplane patrols would be almost impossible. And then he would have to survive re-entry to Earth, which was no doubt swarming with praying mantis fighters.
Prepare for takeoff.
The moth rammed shut, and the craft trembled slightly as its vertical thrusters pushed it off the landing pad and then through the open hangar doors. Rising up over the surface, Tig got a good look at Kepler Station through the starboard viewport. The base was alive with activity. Construction equipment that had been once used to mine for resources is now being repurposed to dig deep underground and create new shelters for the refugees. Newly constructed gates blocked off the entrances leading beneath the surface. LDC troopers watched from observation towers. Mounted plasma turrets pointed out at the convoys of rovers hauling supplies underground. Tig turned toward the portside viewport. Hundreds of shuttles that had fled Earth on E-Day were now stationed amid the regolith. A moth patrolled over the empty spacecrafts. On the horizon, a pair of space planes burned away from the lunar surface, their blue thrusters glowing as they rocketed toward space and vanished against the twinkle of distant stars. The moth accelerated and banked right over Kepler Crater. The inner walls of the crater were carved into terraces, all the way down to the floor, nearly 2 miles deep at its lowest point and 20 miles in diameter. They flew over the central rise, where a small station was positioned. Tig had heard there was a bunker deep beneath it, just in case Kepler Station was destroyed. With thrusters booming, the spacecraft rocketed toward the dark side of the moon. Tig closed his eyes, welcoming the brief reprieve. When he woke, he was greeted with a view of a different, immense crater, humanity's best guarded secret.
Welcome to the Shackleton Crater. Prepare for landing.
It was hard to imagine the machines didn't know about Mesopotamia, but Tig's job was to ensure that it was safe if they did find it. He peered out of the expansive black hole. In a way, it reminded Tig of the images he had seen of Megacity Tokyo, where the Poseidon Cannon had erased his former home and millions of citizens in the blink of an eye. This crater, made by an asteroid billions of years ago, was pitch black, no light penetrating to the bottom. That was the one reason why the colony was built there. The moth rotated, giving Tig a beautiful view of sharp mountains lining the ridge of the crater. The sharp crests seemed to glow in the sunlight.
It's beautiful.
Ronald leaned closer to the viewport.
Peaks of eternal light. They're almost always illuminated by the sun. That crater is 3.6 billion years old.
So, you're like a super nerd or what?
No, I'm just not a meathead like you.
Oi, play nice, kids. Or Uncle Walsh will spank both you dumbasses out the hatch.
Ronald and Joaquin coolly eyed each other as Veronica suppressed a laugh. The moth turned again and the landing thrusters fired. Tig watched the illuminated mountains and saw objects that looked like spears sticking straight out of the peaks. The spacecraft banked hard, shaking. Veronica looped her fingers around her restraints.
You're a long way from home, kid. Better get used to this shit.
Out of the window, the regolith rose to meet the landing gear. A vortex of lunar dust twisted around the thrusters until they clicked off. The moth sat down with a thud. Tig unbuckled his harness and set off across the deck, his mag boots making each step slow and deliberate. After he threw a lever, the door whisked open to the shining mountains. They had landed on a flat plain surrounded by rocks and hills. A trio of interconnected dome-shaped habitats were set at the base of the black and gray bluffs.
Fall out!
Six troopers patrolled up a rocky path to the top where two cannons, each as long as the Maw, were pointed toward Earth. Tige and his three comrades had all stopped to stare at the ball of brown that was partially covered by shadow. Corporal Flores tilted his head as he gazed at Earth.
Holy shit. Is that smoke?
Tige focused his INVS eyes on an area that appeared to be what was once eastern China. The southern part of the former country was covered in shadow, but there were still lights from the great megacities. Maybe there were more people surviving in the chaos and destruction than he'd realized. Squinting, he zoomed in further. What he'd seen weren't lights. They were fires, burning against the scorched flesh of the Earth.
Come on, kids.
He turned away and started toward the command habitat. The structure was positioned between two colossal moon rocks. When they reached the habitat, they opened a containment hatch and stepped inside an anteroom chamber. The hatch sealed behind them, then air whooshed inside. After taking off his helmet, Tige stepped up to the inner hatch. On the other side, three officers in armor stood in the command center, hovering around a holo screen. They all turned as the hatch opened. A husky man with gray hair and a goatee stepped forward.
You must be Engine Sergeant Tige Walsh?
Tige nodded.
I'm Lieutenant General David Stahl, and this is LDC Lieutenant Commander Rhett Fox.
Steyo nodded to a man with a glistening, shaven head. He wasn't a soldier like Steyo. He was a Falconer, one of the Intel commanders, wearing a black uniform.
I'm glad you're here. However, I fear we might already be too late.
A low rumble shook through the habitat. Through a viewport, Tai could see King Cobra space planes rising out of the Shackleton crater.
What's going on?
That second attack we feared might have already started. War Commander Thacker has sent out a warning to all stations due to events unfolding outside of Earth's orbit.
What kind of events are we talking about?
Fox activated a holoscreen.
This is the current imagery from Nova 1 station.
Tig looked at a rotating image of a star-shaped space station. The former space center had once been the final stop outside of Earth's orbit for shuttles and transport destined for the moon. Now it was surrounded by smooth, insect-like spacecraft.
Praying mantis fighters.
They haven't been this close since the cannons fired on Earth.
Tig studied the image and then looked out the viewport again at Earth.
You're sure this is the start of the next major attack?
It seems like it.
Corporal Bryan studied the holoscreen, then looked up.
I don't know, sir. I really don't think this is it.
What makes you say that?
Because if this really was the full Phase 2 attack we've been worried about, we wouldn't see it coming like this.
Everyone turned to face the young corporal.
The machines aren't going to give us a warning before they attack.
Tig agreed with a hefty nod.
Nope, Ronald's right. When they really attack us, it'll happen quicker than a sucker punch to the face. We better stop wasting time and start analyzing these defenses, because we don't want to be caught with our pants down when the time comes.
The CIC of the NAA Pelican was dead quiet. All around Akira, the officers sat or stood at their stations, watching and listening. War Commander Kontos waited with Akira, both of them studying the passive sonar with Okami seated on his haunches nearby. Nothing out there, at least not yet. The submarine purred quietly as it descended deeper into the Mariana Trench. They had repaired her to the best that they could before diving. They were going to need some luck to survive the crushing darkness. If any of the damaged compartments gave, it could cause a chain reaction they wouldn't be able to stop. Akira tried to ignore that possibility as he studied the screen. If the machines did know where they were, they weren't revealing their positions. Then again, he wasn't sure if Apeiron or Dr. Otto Cross had sent them. The thought of multiple enemies hunting them made Akira tense. So did the idea of leading the machines to Neptune Research Station, assuming they weren't already there. Akira had considered retreating to his quarters and sitting down with his new warrior codex, but he still couldn't bring himself to recreate the family stories seared into his mind. And he still didn't really have anything new to add. Everything was quiet. Far too quiet.
We're closing in on Neptune. War Commander, should we try to hail them?
One short-range blast on an encrypted channel.
Yes, sir.
The captain gave the comms officer a nod, and the young ensign turned back to her station.
Neptune Station, this is the NASF Pelican. Do you read?
Maybe their comms are down.
Maybe.
There were other options. Either no one was left, or whoever was down there, good or bad, didn't want to be found. Even if the science personnel still had control of the station, they wouldn't want to broadcast that they had survived for everyone to hear.
Try again. If their comms aren't down, it's possible they think we're trying to trick them.
A response could also be a trick. When those squids attacked, somehow they managed to call over our encrypted channels.
I know. We cannot underestimate the machines. And if anyone truly is alive on Neptune, it's wise of them to do the same. Whatever the case, Captain Akira, we'll hope for the best. But your team should prepare for the worst.
Always do.
Akira and Kantos, with Okami following, entered the portal room where the other engines waited, including Jackson.
I'm coming with.
Fine, as long as you listen to orders.
Jackson and Akira shared a nod. Pistons Bella and Toretto were on standby for medical support. The bulkheads rumbled like a hungry stomach. Akira and the other soldiers silently spread out, preparing and checking over their equipment. No one joked around or traded the usual banter that came before a mission. Even Okami seemed to sense the danger. The droid dog curled up on the deck in front of Akira, glancing up nervously every few seconds.
It's okay.
The ship contradicted his statement by groaning. Akira checked his HUD. He watched the depth tick higher and higher, 8,000 meters and counting. They were already almost 5 miles under the surface. Somewhere deep in the guts of the submarine, metal groaned and screeched. 9,000 meters. Akira tried to focus on a good memory of his family. He pictured Yui and Takeshi at a farmer's market in Mega City, Tokyo. He remembered carrying Takeshi on his shoulders and showing him the different fresh fish in the stands and tanks and the tiny shrimp Takeshi demanded his father buy him for a pet. Then the worst moment of his life clawed into his mind. When he had rowed Kijiro all the way to the shelter where Yui and Takeshi had been during the Coalition bombing. Injured and exhausted, Akira had dug through the rubble, finding his family and the shrimp. Takeshi had taken it with him in a glass jar. The small creature was crushed, dead, along with Yui. Akira had pried their still-breathing boy from her cold grip that night. He pushed the memories away as his HUD read 10,500 meters. Akira looked over to the engines, all stoic and standing tall. This wasn't so different than riding in an aircraft over enemy territory. They all knew the safety of their lives was currently out of their control. On his HUD, Akira opened mirrored images of the sub's forward cameras. At first he saw nothing but Stygian blackness. Then something appeared. A few shapes appeared, distant and gray at the bottom of the trench. This was it. They'd made it. They had arrived at Neptune Station. The four habitats were nestled along a ridge that dropped off deeper into the trenches. Soon, if all went to plan, it would be the new command post for the Nova Alliance Strike Force.
Almost there. Get ready to board the station.
Akira strode up to the hatch. Frost and Ghost came up on his flanks, weapons ready. Jackson came up on their rear guard. Okami wedged his way between Akira's legs and glanced up, ready to go. Captain Thomas guided the submarine toward the outer hatch of a three-story habitat. The lights within the station had been completely turned off, revealing none of the secrets within. He checked to see if the sensors were detecting any energy readings. Sure enough, several of the habitats gave off a faint signature of the thermal sensors. Something was still powering the station, which meant it might still be operational. The submarine maneuvered slowly toward the outer hatch of the habitat. A deep thud resonated from the hatch when it made contact with the Pelican. Several mechanical clicks and whines sounded from the outside of the hatch as Captain Thomas engaged the docking mechanisms.
We're secure. Make contact with any staff and let them know we're here to help. And if the worst has happened, if it's the machines that are in control, then eliminate them.
Akira signaled the Ghost, who spun the hatch's wheel to unlock it.
Death from the shadows.
Together, we are one.
Ghost slowly opened the first hatch. Akira slipped into the tunnel that formed a bridge between the sub and Neptune Station. Okami crept ahead with Frost right behind them, her rifle aimed at the next hatch that would lead them into the habitat. Jackson hovered behind them, his wide shoulders nearly touching the bulkhead on both sides of the passage. They made their way up behind Ghost, who held the wheel on the entrance hatch. Akira gave a nod. The wheel clicked, and the hatch unlocked. Okami growled as soon as it cracked open. Akira was the first one inside the habitat, his heart flipping at the sight of their enemy, an AI-powered blue Hummer droid. It watched them from the other end of the passage with a glowing facial screen.
Contact. The station appears to be compromised.
Akira moved his finger to the trigger as the droid started to turn. Jackson fired and bolts tore past Akira and slammed into the bulkhead, just as the boxy droid took off running before Akira could give the order.
Pursuing hostile.
Akira took off running with his rifle clutched against his chest. The hatches between the droid and the Shadow Squad all began to slam down, stopping him mid-stride. There was no response over the comms, but a thud sounded behind the engines. It took Akira all of a second to know what caused it. The Pelican had undocked from the station. Shadow Squad was on their own.